Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to The Writing Mama. This is your host, V.S. Grenier, obviously show host, author, editor, you name it. I pretty much do it in the nowadays. So I welcome you guys to the show, and, of course, I have our other co-host, Marsha Casper-Cook, who's an agent, a writer, and a show host, and pretty much everything else these days. I feel like, Marsha, we do everything.
Hi. I know. My friends tell me to focus, so I am. I'm focusing on 20 things rather than 50.
20 things instead of the 100? Yeah, I understand it. And today my blood pressure is down from last week's show. I didn't check in, my promise.
That was a fast show last week. I thought we were, like, zipping through. I don't even know what happened. It went so fast.
Yeah, so we welcome everybody tonight to our show, The Writing Mama, and we're really excited about tonight because we have a guest who pretty much has her hands in every single, and I can literally say, cooking pot, because we have Amy Finley on the show, and she actually is a gourmet chef, and I'm pretty sure most of our listeners are familiar with Amy because she was formerly on Food Network, and in the third season was the winner of the next Food Network star to host a show, and she had her own show, and I think it was The Chef Next Door.
The Gourmet Next Door.
See,
the Gourmet
really
Next
close.
Door, you got it. We try to be close here. We try to be somewhat.
Yes, we try and get close. I don't have
close
all my notes.
Close is good enough, right?
Yeah, and then you also now, yeah, and Amy's now an author. She has a book out called How to Eat a Small Country, A Family's Pursuit to Happiness One Meal at a Time, and what I love about this book is it's not just your typical book that we normally have on here of, like, fiction, you know, within children's or within the adult realm. It's actually a nonfiction book about what you experienced from going on to the reality show of being the next Food Network star, what it was like being on your own show, and then, of course, everything that happened with your family personally, and then basically saying, I'm done, and heading off to France to basically to save your family. So,
six-month-long decompression. Yeah.
So, welcome to the show. Now, you're back, obviously, from France. You're back home in San Diego. So, are you glad to be back in sunny California, or do you miss the weather out there in Europe?
Oh, no. I am very glad to be back in sunny San Diego. You know, I there was one thing that I was totally floored by my reaction to. It was to the weather in France.
Yeah.
You know, I think I actually said it in the book, something about that, you know, one thing's for sure, that Californians have absolutely no idea what to do when faced with weather. And we just got
handed a doozy
of about 6 months of every time when it should have been beautiful. We went to the beach in Corsica even to go and have, you know, like a get back our California sunshine and our beachy, you know, mindsets and mentality vacation, a vacation from our vacation. And then it even rained on us in Corsica, which was almost just, you know, too much. I actually thought I was going to fall apart a little bit when it didn't stop raining.
Yeah. Where are you from originally? Where are you from? Are you from California?
I'm born and raised in San Diego. Yeah,
oh, really?
I'm a true dyed-in-the-wool, born and raised. My dad calls us the sunshine supermen that we just need way more, I think, than your average person's vitamin D in order to get happily through our days.
Right, so you won't be coming to Chicago in winter, I don't think. It's not a place for you here.
Oh, boy.
I know.
Chicago in winter would definitely be a stretch for me, I have to say. You guys are tough.
It's a stretch for me.
Yeah.
I live here. It's horrible.
Yeah, Marsha lives there. And You know, I'm out in Utah. This is Virginia, and I live out here, which I told you before the show. And I'm in southern Utah, so I don't have the extreme crazy weather that you know the Salt Lake Valley has. But I'm actually originally from Southern California. That's actually my hometown. And I actually and all my college I did was in San Diego. So when I was as I said earlier, I'm reading your book. And when I thought you were born and raised in San Diego, I'm starting to think, oh my gosh, you know, we were pretty much in the same area.
Did you go to San Diego State?
No, I went. My background's actually just so weird since I'm in editing and publishing and a writer. But my background's merchandise marketing, so I actually went to the Fashion Institute in the heart of downtown San Diego. Yeah, right there. So,
yeah. Are you going to say where you worked or no? Yeah.
Oh, I've worked everywhere. I've worked for Petite Sophisticate, Casual Corner, Fredericks of Hollywood, Hot Topic. I helped open their first set of Torrid stores, which is a plus size division. The last place I worked before.
See, who would know? That's what I knew, but that's why I asked you the question because I already knew what you.
Well,
were
yeah, and the and no. the last place I worked for was Brighton Collectibles, and I loved working there, but. And it's funny. I just reading your book. I'm halfway through. I haven't finished it yet. But I get a lot of turmoil that you've gone through. I really feel for you because this was like in a really short time span. But because when my husband met me, you know, I was a very ambitious person. Just as I pick up from your book, you seem very ambitious, and you know, because you wanted a sense of adventure. I mean, you met your husband, and then packed your bags and went to France with him. I mean, I don't know if I've been that gutsy, but I'm pretty gutsy. But you know, I was in fashion, and it's a very fast-paced lifestyle, and to basically put the brakes on and walk, because I literally walked away from my career, very much how you walked away. You know, I'm not going to say you walked away 100% from your career, but you know, you did walk away from the really fast-paced part of being, you know, a chef. Mm-hmm. And you know,
I think, you know, more than that, something that I bet you, it sounds like you and I both share, is, you know, more than that, I had started working when I was 15 years old. I mean, I had my first job when I was 15, you know, and I worked all through high school. I mean, it was, you know, if I wanted to have gas to be able to get anywhere, I had, you know, well, for that matter, if I wanted a car, and then I wanted gas, if I wanted clothes, if I wanted to do things with my friends. I mean, so I worked all through high school. I went to UCLA, and I worked almost full-time all the way through UCLA, including, you know, really full-time every summer working as a camp counselor. And, you know, and then as soon as I graduated from school, I went straight into my first job. For my first job, I went straight into my second job. I mean, I never was somebody who wasn't working. It was a big part of my sense of self, you know, that self-efficacy, that what I can accomplish as a function of my own effort. So I was really pretty, you know, deeply invested in this idea that, you know, by working hard, I was going to be able to manage my future. So walking away from, you know, work in the first place when I first started staying home with children, that was a real shocker.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up because, you know, when I was reading the beginning of your book, because you talk about that, how you had a lot of I love my husband dearly too, but there are times I absolutely, you know, do get that resentful feeling toward him because, you know, I was traveling a lot as a buyer, and then to like when I got I was with our first child, I was still working, but when we went to have our second, you know, same kind of thing. You know how your husband made it's so funny. When I read the part where your husband said, "Well, the mother's the cornerstone of the family."
Yeah.
I like to book and hit my husband.
Well, we are, even though we're crazy people, all of us that we're working.
Yeah,
but we are.
I hit my husband.
I know. Sometimes you think to yourself, "Is this really such a stable cornerstone here? Do we want something that's maybe a little sturdier?"
And I just started cracking up. I was just like, "Oh my gosh!" He's like, "What did you hit me at the book for?" I said, "He's like you. You know, you think you should stay home and take care of the kids. You understand? We start climbing the walls." Because that's what I did. I mean, that's why I moved to Utah. So I could quit. He could support us, you know. But, I mean, from going, like, you know, like how you were saying, you work, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're at home taking care of a kid. You're like, what do I do now?
Which is, of course, also work, but it's just an entirely different type of work.
Right,
and it's
the
type
of
work that you don't have the, you know, the perks of getting up in the morning and putting yourself together and walking out the door and feeling, you know what I mean?
You don't
sort of that armor that you put on in order to face the professional world.
And I was going to say, you also don't get to go home and leave it behind you.
Right.
It follows you.
Nope. Exactly. Well, which is interesting because, you know, one of the things, you know, I mean, obviously my husband had some really strong objections. Well, I don't know if it's obvious, but I mean, that's in part what the book is about. Is my husband had some real objections to my working in television. And what's interesting is that a part of it was, you know, it's in the book, you know, I recall a conversation between the two of us where he said, I don't want to be married to the next Rachel Ray. But what was interesting, you know, and, you know, subsequently, you know, I think I've made him rehash that conversation with me, of course, you know, multiple times.
Okay. Well,
but,
you
know,
you don't count those
comments
because those conversations
right.
are like ongoing.
Right. But one of the things that the points that he makes, too, is he'll say, well, you know, I also didn't want to be married to, like, an airline captain or a military officer or the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. I mean, he was worried about sort of like the distraction that would come with the job because it was a job that you really sort of, you know, be doing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It would always be on your mind. It would be sort of a distraction, which was, on one hand, you know, I could completely understood. And then on the other hand, you go, but yet motherhood is exactly the same thing. It's a 24-hour a day, seven-day a week job that is kind of, it's a distraction from, you know, taking care of yourself sometimes. It's a distraction from your marriage. And it sounds like a loaded word to use the word distraction, but the point is that, you know, once you're a working parent of any type, you know, whether you're male or female, it's just it's accepting the fact that you're never going to have a single-track brain again. You know, you're always going to be scattered and a little bit distracted and trying to manage too many things all at the same time.
Which, you
that's
know,
what women do, though, but don't a lot of women, I mean, even when you're home, you're doing the laundry, you're doing cooking, you're taking the kids to the doctor, you're doing, but we're never doing just one thing.
Which I want to talk about a little bit, you know, because, I mean, you're totally hitting exactly what the show's about. You know, obviously, you know, you're wanting to see, you didn't even think you were even going to win, obviously, you know, being the next Food Network host. And, you know, your husband's completely on the other side just going, like, what the heck were you thinking? So looking back at that, you know, which, you know, is so great with hindsight, you can always look back and go, okay, you know, what I learned from this experience. You know, when you were in the experience, did you feel you were juggling things okay? And then looking back, you know, what is your perspective really on what you were thinking at the time and how well you were trying to do that balancing out? Because, I mean, a lot of, you know,
like you mean
like,
to be –
well, just
like
you're
the juggling act.
A lot of people. Sorry, go ahead, Amy.
You go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, because there's a lot of people, you know, who think, you know, being a writer, you know, being on radio, being on TV, they think, oh, well, you know, you have all this help because you must be making all this money. And the reality is it's never like, especially starting out, it's never like that. So, I mean, I want you to kind of share what that was like for you. When you're there, and of course,
I am our household everything. I mean, it's you know, I do, you know, my husband and I think we've gotten better, because here's one thing that was certainly the case before is, you know, we had, and I think that this is something that, you know, with hindsight and stuff that I realize better now, is that when you have really young kids, you do go into a tunnel, and in that tunnel, I think you do forget that they're ever going to grow up and you're ever going to be able to do more than you currently feel like, you know, you can do, because they're going to be able to do more than you think you can do. And that period is so, like, you know, you just can't imagine that life is ever going to change. But but my husband and I think now, so at the time, we just really didn't have a balance. I mean, I was 100% on kids and household. He was 100% on work. And he, you know, and I probably was doing some of those things that a lot of, and I would still consider myself a new mother, even at, you know, when I had a one-year-old and a four-year-old, because, you know, once you'd add, you know, kid number two into the equation, everything changed. You know, I had sort of come to a feeling of understanding, you know, how to, you know, be juggling marriage and child, and I always, you know, I did various things on the side while, you know, once Indiana came along, and, you know, I did freelance writing, and I could juggle a little bit. I was doing
some stuff. You can do something from your house,
Yeah, exactly. Well, which is very much the way I operate now too. I mean, now, you know, I've kind of gone much more back into sort of, you know, being the writer, and that is what I do. I'm home all the time. Sometimes I actually have days where I just long to get in the car and go anywhere because I want to see the other side of the freeway. I want to see, you know, San Diego. As we talk about, we joke in San Diego about, you know, there's a freeway that sort of divides it into sort of the west and the east, and I live in East County, and every once in a while I just pine to cross that freeway and go and see the west side of San Diego again, because I have to have a reason to do it, because otherwise all of my reasons are here at home. You know, I'm tied to the drop-off and the pickup schedule in the morning, you know, with kids, and, you know, and that's, it's rigid. It doesn't change. It's, you know, it must be done by 8 in the morning, and it must be done again by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then it's just a constant wedging, you know, all day long of what can I fit in where, including a little bit, too. What can I do to keep the household going, and I'm trying to be better now, like, something I think I, at the time, again, going back to, say, before Food Network, that we were pretty poor at, was I had just, you know, I'd done what a lot of people do, where I just stopped doing things like even going to exercise classes for myself, or, I trying, once, especially once we had a second kid, trying to do much in the way of working. I'd even really given up cooking. You know, I didn't, I just sort of, it was a part of kind of being resentful, I think, at Greg and at the situation, and just feeling kind of trapped, as I lost my joy of cooking, because I missed kind of, you know, what I thought of as kind of cooking for real. I missed being in a professional environment cooking, where I could feel, you know, competent and masterful, and I could be creative, and instead I, the kind of cooking that I was going to need to do at home at the time, especially with a one-year-old and a four-year-old,
not
was
creative,
just, you know, utilitarian, get it on the table before people have a meltdown kind of cooking. And so, you know, we're better now. My husband and I, the thing that was really great about France for us was that in order to make it through the trip, you know, to live at home, we lived in a farmhouse together in Burgundy, so he was working from home, which meant that he was now, you know, full-time sort of on my turf, and, you know, being around the kids, and he took on responsibilities, you know, of that he hadn't been a part of before. So he did the school drop-off and the school pick-up, for example, you know, for their various
so then he saw how hard this is. It's not that easy to do that.
Yeah, and I that was something that really benefited us, was that he got to do the juggle. You know, for 6 months, we all juggled. I mean, when we were doing road trips, we would sometimes have to pull over into, like, service stations off the highway where they had Wi-Fi so that he could use Skype to call into conference calls for his work. And, you know, and then the kids and I would go and play in a parking lot, you know, like the gas station parking lot for an hour while we waited for him to get done, and then we could get back on
the road. But it's like you're always looking at your watch, and it's never a really relaxed day, because you're always looking at what time it is, because you got to do something.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to live a lot by the calendar and live a lot by, you know, we have 20 minutes for this. And the only thing I think that's great that comes out of it is that, you know, kids who sometimes have absolutely no perspective on how long anything takes, I have to assume that living with a mom who's always saying, we have five minutes, that maybe it impresses upon them this real sense of actual time passing or something.
No, I think you're so true in what you're saying, because, I mean, what you and your husband learned while you guys were in France, and the fact that he was home actually helping to take on, you know, a chunk of the responsibility of juggling the kids, so you guys could both. Because I know in one part of your book, you made the comment that you guys had to kind of set the schedule, you know, who was going to take which, you know, time in the morning to do their job. And my husband now is in a position at work, because he works for the city of St. George out here in the dispatch center, and he's not a police officer, but he works in the dispatch center and was a dispatch supervisor, and he actually helps maintain all the emergency responder computer systems. And so now he has a little bit more leeway where he can work from home, and he just sees, now that I'm back out of, because I take a hiatus for about a year, because I actually have a 14-month-old. And I have a now 6-year-old and soon to be 15-year-old. So I really honestly relate a lot with you. And
but
what
you were, but
happened.
You were actually she was doing that, and I called her up, and I had an ad that I wanted somebody to help me on my radio show. So then Virginia,
you dragged her out of retirement.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that. And then 2 minutes later, she's like being a host with me, because it was great having her on the show. So we just, you know,
and then
that was it.
And then
that was it.
Yeah, well, and then I restarted my online children's magazine, and so now the rest is history. But, you know, now he's actually trying to work a few days from home, and so he'll, run our daughter, because she has afternoon kindergarten, run her to school and stuff. And he just looks at me, he's like, I don't know how you do it. And I'm just like, I sit Sabrina in the high chair, I get her fed, and while she's eating, I'm pulling out my laptop, and I'm, like, sending, like, 50 emails, and I'm like, you just kind of have to, he's used to time management because you have to be, obviously when you're working with the EMS and the fire and the police, he understands that, but he didn't realize that I was doing that in the home environment.
I called you one day, and I said, we're talking, and I said, she's like out of breath. She's like putting tiles in the floor. We're like, what are you doing? I mean, it's like, it's never, you're always, we're all doing this, and we don't realize the things that we do. Like, I'm sometimes doing the laundry while I'm talking on the phone. The good thing for cell phones is you can walk around now. You don't have to sit.
Right. Right.
I think
what's, I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but I think that, it is sad that we do all tend to undervalue how much women that are working in the home, like who are, truly staying at home moms who aren't trying to juggle career and how, how much work that really is. I mean, it's an exhausting amount of work. I mean, to get up in the morning and be pretty much, completely at the mercy of other people's needs all day long.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot like it's a lot like being a nurse. It's a lot like being a teacher. It's, you are all of those things all at the same time. Plus, then trying to maintain a semblance a semblance of yourself and stuff inside of that as well is it's tough. It's really a struggle. And I know, as far as juggling goes, I know a lot of people who do it much, much better and much more gracefully than I can. That's something that I'm
You know what, though? Sometimes you really don't know that. I mean, it may look that way, but, not everybody shows themselves about what they do. Like we're talking about it, but like some people, like I always say, I was a lab technician. I used to draw blood and everything like that, and I was used to getting blood all over me and things, and then I look at people and I see them, they're wearing like a whole white outfit. I go, like, don't you ever get dirty? I mean, like, you're just sitting there, and it's like I drinking coffee, I'm bringing it into my office, and then the coffee spills on me. I mean, like, some people just don't ever look like they ever do anything, but they actually do, but you just don't see them.
Well, and everyone is hard on themselves. I know that I am, I have a long habit of being hard on myself and assuming that everybody does things better than I do. And it's true. We never get to see anybody's, behind closed doors struggle, which was probably the thing that I, I wouldn't necessarily say it was something that I enjoyed or that I was sent out to do purposefully when I was writing my memoir, but something that I realized I did kind of ask, once it was over and once I was reading it through, was I decided, unconsciously, I guess, to not varnish anything and to not whitewash the fact that, it's hard, especially when we were road tripping all over the country, to keep your kids, looking presentable and that they're brushed and, washed looking all of the time. And, because sometimes a big part of that juggling is deciding where your priorities lie. And, for me, one of my biggest priorities, balancing working from home, and my husband works from home too now most of the time, which is, an additional layer of our craziness around our house, is that we're still splitting sort of time slots because he has a job where he, most of his coworkers and colleagues are on the East Coast. He's one of the few people on the West Coast, so he does a lot of, conference calls and telecons that start at 5 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning.
It's actually 3 hours in New York. Three, that's right. In New York.
And for the longest time, we've worked out of a space where, we didn't have an office. We have, a desk in our bedroom, which meant that, sometimes you have 5 o'clock in the morning telecons that start, which just means, it's now time for the whole house to wake up because there's no place to go and have it even be quiet. Dad's working, so it's time to get up.
So it's a whole day, 24 hours of something going on.
Mm-hmm. No, Amy. I kind of want to talk a little bit about when you were on, on the Food Network show to, basically, competing to become a Food Network host, and then obviously you won, and you did a season. What was the stress of that like? I mean, I know what the stress is like as a writer, but I can't even imagine what the stress would be like working with a whole production crew. I mean, How
you're not your own
you
boss,
in it.
Right? You're not your own boss.
I would say, the thing that was always the easiest part for me about it was the cooking. The cooking was is natural. It's I was always glad once the cameras would actually finally start rolling, because once the camera started rolling, it usually meant that then I could just go ahead and put my head down and go to work and start cooking.
Right, right,
and that
right.
was the relaxing part of it. Actually, I was, you know, I was always, once we, the challenges, you know, when we did Next Food Network Star, the challenges, you know, I actually looked forward to them, because once, you know, the hard part was sort of waiting in anticipation of what they were going to be, you know, what was going to be the crazy catch or whatnot. And then for me, you know, I was juggling sort of my own, you know, personal baggage, because on the, you know, the side of everything was the stress of what was happening on the home front and the phone calls that I
right.
was taking from my husband, which sort of added, you know, added a definite
yeah.
extra layer of tension. So, like I said, it was nice when the cameras would start rolling and all there was to do was cook, because
right.
that was something where, you know, cooking for me is my decompression. That's I know what I'm doing when I'm cooking, and I don't second guess myself. And so that was actually a nice, that was the nicest part of me, is to be able to.
Well,
you said
that's a comfortable
get into the
place.
Rhythm of
it was comfortable.
Mhm. Exactly. So, and that was the thing that I probably enjoyed, you know, the most about it, was the chance to be cooking again, and cooking again at a particular level where there were very high expectations, and, you know, you couldn't, you know, with people like Bobby Flay getting ready to then cut into your dish at the end and give you an evaluation on it, you couldn't,
right.
you know, you couldn't take shortcuts, you couldn't afford to be sloppy. I mean, you were doing your best work, and that felt really nice, because that was the sort of the self-imposed pressure from working in a professional kitchen that I think I really missed, you know, that drive
mm-hmm.
to be on your A game, to be pulling together all of your knowledge, all of your skills, having to do things like manage your time, watch the clock. I mean, that was very much like working in a restaurant kitchen. So that was kind of soothing, and that was where I got sort of that the most sense of sort of professional satisfaction. And it was very much, for me, it was like going back to work. I didn't give myself a lot of time to think about the other aspects of it, because too, when you're shooting any kind of a television program, it's happening in a different space and time than when that television program then becomes aired. I mean, that's a whole different experience in and of itself. The creation of the television program is very intimate. You know, there's not, you know, viewers, there's just you and the, you know, producers and camera guys, and everybody, you know, quickly becomes friendly with each other. There's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of, you know, backing each other up, and, you know, you got a sense
right.
of people really wanting you to succeed, not of people looking for you to, you know, make a catastrophic mistake and fail. And so that was all very, it was really nice. It was pleasurable, which was the,
Well, you're like a master at your game, though. So then you're confident, and then, you know, that's a
right.
good place to be. And some people never get there.
Yeah.
So, you know, in
right.
a lot
and
of
I, and I,
go ahead.
Well, I was just saying that's I know when I sent the tape in the first place, that was what I was looking for. I wasn't looking for. I don't think I was even looking for. I was maybe looking for a full-time job, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
and a full-time job that I thought I could actually, you know, I could make this work, because it seems like it'll be a full-time job, but that will occur in spurts. And I thought that might be something that I might be able to make work with my family life, because I will have intense spurts, but in between the intense spurts of work and activity, I thought, well, I'll be able to go home and I'll be able to put it aside, and I'll go back to my regular life and take care of my kids and be there for drop-offs and pickups, and essentially nothing will change. I did have a hope that it might be, you know, kind of a very out-of-the-box solution for how to be a working parent that still felt like they spent the majority of their time at home. You know, the thing that was too bad was my husband just didn't see it in the same way, because he saw it instead as something that, yes, you will have these concentrated periods where you're gone, but he really did see all the way through to the fact that you don't really get to put that sort of a career behind
right.
you at the end of the day, because not only would there be expectations for things like to go to food festivals or maybe make other sorts of, you know, personal appearances in order to kind of continually be promoting your show and whatnot, but that also it would be, gosh, it's, you know, the kind of a job that you are your job. And, you know, for him, I think, you know, he was thinking, if I'm, you know, I am my job, and he's married to me, then he's also married to my job. And that was something that was really, for him, it was, you know, that was, he didn't know
to
be married
when
to
you started
job.
Cooking, were you very young when you started to cook and do, you know, or make creations, or did it just happen?
Oh, yeah, I was, my grandmother was the first person who got me cooking in the kitchen. You know, she was a great raised in Louisiana cook, and her mother had run like a little restaurant and a store, a little grocery store, during the Depression. And so my grandmother was always in the kitchen. She was, you know, the person when you walked in the door, and I would say that she, you know, had the master of the eight greatest language and the words in the human language, which are, you know, hello, dear, can I make you a chicken?
Yeah,
and she was,
I know, my
you know,
grandmother
was
like, I always remember her cooking. That's, you know, what she did. She
yeah.
was always in the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. Grandma was always yeah. in the kitchen. She never walked out. I don't think she ever even came to the table when the rest of us were eating. She just
right.
stayed in the kitchen and started
washing
either working on the next thing that was
right.
coming out or started
yeah.
washing the dishes. Exactly. And she always let me play with her in the kitchen. She used to let me make soup. We would open up the refrigerator, and I could take anything and everything out of the vegetable bins and put it into a pot and add water, and then she'd show me how to season it, and we'd boil it and make soup, and my grandpa would eat it, and she would eat it, and I think they always had turnips in the house, so I always put turnips in the soup, and then based on that, I would never eat the soup, which was, you know, kind of funny. Although now I
right,
love
right, right. Well, that's just an old gift. Do you watch that new show that they have with the restaurant? Do you watch the new one? You know,
I don't even
Bobby
have
Flay.
Television, which is actually very
are
odd,
you really?
Considering
oh.
that I've worked in television. No television.
You don't have a
nope.
Really? Wow.
No television.
Amy,
yeah,
Amy, we have
a
caller.
We've never had one.
Yeah. Amy, we have a caller who actually has a question for you about when you were on the Food Network show. Bennett,
sure.
go ahead and ask him your question.
Hi, how are you, Amy?
Hi, Bennett. Hello. Hi, Mary.
Good, how are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, when they told you you had to do so many shows, did you plan the menu, or did they say we need something with beef or pork or a vegetable, or how was that? Did you arrange, or how was your shows arranged?
Ooh, good question.
Thank you.
We knew we were doing the. Yeah, no, that's a good one. It's insightful because I was always curious about that myself. How much input do, for example, you know, like an on show or a chef actually get to put into their own show? So they gave me, you know, they said we need 6 episodes, and they didn't. I don't think they gave me a balance of, you know, how many of this or how many of that. But what we did do is I think I threw out, I needed to do 6, and I think I probably threw out, you know, 20 or so ideas. And the thing that was always set was the format, which was that you would do sort of 3 items or 3 dishes per show. So that you, and the idea kind of being that you would do something that was like an appetizer and then an entree and then a dessert. Or something. It didn't necessarily have to be those 3 things, but you did have to sort of do 3 dishes from start to finish. And so I threw out sort of my 20. And for me, when I was putting mine together, I was trying to think of like cooking techniques that the person would get out of these shows. Because my approach to food is sort of less in terms of if I was going to be. I looked at the show as a way to teach people to cook. And for me, the best way to teach people to cook is not to teach people recipes, but to teach them techniques. So when I was organizing, you know, the recipes that we ended up doing for the show, that the ones that they picked, they were picking them from a list of 20 things where it was as I was setting each, you know, potential show menu, I was thinking about, you know, what a person was going to learn about cooking from one of or all 3 of these different dishes that were going to be completed in the show. How's that? Is that pretty good?
It works for me. Why? Well, one other question. Do you keep communication with any of the other hosts or the other the competitors in the Food Network family?
Yeah. Paul McCullough was on my same season, and Paul has become, you know, during the show, he became a really, really great friend because he was a very strong shoulder to lean on, you know, during the bad phone calls that were going on between me and my husband back at home. And he was such a cheerful guy, such a great spirit, such a very, very just genuinely good, nice human being. So Paul and I have always stayed in touch, and I go up and I see him in L.A., and he's come down to San Diego and seen me here. And then Colombe, she was actually the one who ended up introducing us to Mark and Sophie, who are the couple in France that we ended up renting our farmhouse from. So Colombe and I still stay in touch, and she just had a baby in December. And the other people, I stay in touch with Patrick on Facebook, and I think in various other sets of us stay in touch with each other as well. We had a really nice season. We had a really amicable group. Everybody was really, nice and supportive of each other. It was the first time, I believe, that they had the cast of that show all live together in an apartment. I think before they had used hotel rooms. And if they were looking
all lived
for
together?
Sort of bonding.
Wow.
Yeah, we all lived together. We had bunk beds. The girls were all in one room with bunk beds, and the boys were all in another room with bunk beds. And if they were looking to foster camaraderie and relationships, I think it was a successful move because there's a lot of good friendships that came out of it.
Well, that's good, because sometimes you see that on reality shows, they're talking about each other, and you don't know what goes on or if they even talk at all when they're together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I watch a lot of the reality shows. I never watched the season that you were on, Amy, but I do watch the Food Network, and I think that it is an important thing, because a lot of the other networks that have had the reality shows, when they don't have the contestants kind of with each other, think they tend to be a little bit more backbiting than when you guys are all actually in after you're in front of the camera. Well, I guess you're still kind of technically in front of the camera, but off the set where you guys are actually, competing against each other, and you're in more in a home environment, you tend to lean on each other more because of the stress of it all. So, I think, it's probably a great experience for you that you did have that versus being in
the separate rooms.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, because that makes it a worthwhile event that you did in your life, and at least you've come out of it with some friends that you never would have had before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the thing, for example, one of the reasons why my husband had such a difficult time while I was in New York, and there were lots of reasons behind that, but it was also because we're so inside of a bubble that it is true that we didn't have any easy contact with anybody on the outside. You don't get to have regular phone calls. Your telephone calls are on a speaker phone, so And for him, that was really, for him, that just felt very alienating. I mean, I'm his wife, and we couldn't have even a personal conversation that was private between the two of us during the time that we were gone. And we had some serious things to discuss, and yet he knew that they were always going to have to be taped and broadcast. And there was
there's no alone time at all where you are by yourself, where you have to, when you're not on camera. Do they really do everything? I mean, when you're taking a shower, naturally not, but
I'm pretty sure Amy locked herself in the bathroom quite a few times.
Well, when they would let me, I definitely did. I got permission to go and lock myself in the bathroom a couple of times, and that's something that I've always been very appreciative of, and I think that I have a lot of respect for the producers that we worked with and for the integrity of the show that they were trying to create, that considering what kind of a storyline they could have pulled from the whole episode, they made a deliberate choice not to do so, which was so nice. And I
very nice,
because it was the thing that I was, in part, one of the reasons I was so surprised that things went as badly as they did on the home front while I was gone, was because I knew that my husband would have to know, and did know, that if he had to call and have conversations with me, they weren't going to be private, that they would be, and that, he was potentially, I was trying to keep the situation as private as possible, and yet he was making it almost impossible for me to do so by calling and needing to have conversations with me, really, really hard to hear conversations with me that would then end up being taped, and me always sort of dreading trying to figure out how to kind of contain that situation as best as possible so that, it wouldn't be tempting, for example, as a storyline. But it turns out that I didn't have to worry about them.
That was great. That's great. Because that would have ruined it for you. That's not a good thing. You don't need that. That's not anything that you would really want, in your life.
It was, the whole situation was humiliating, so.
Now, I want to come back to your book, How to Eat Small a small country, you know, family's pursuit to happiness, you know, one mile at a time. In your book, I love the fact, and, you know, obviously we've touched on the fact that you do have a background in writing, and obviously you're writing again. I love the fact that you took, because I'm not, I actually have a few people in my family who, you know, they're not, they did go to culinary school and they learned how to cook, but they didn't go to do it professionally, they just did it because they like cooking. And I have a dad who's an airline pilot, and he's always using analogies of flying, and my family members who, you know, have their background in culinary school use analogies. And I love that in your book, you took analogies in food, but you broke it down in a very simple way, and then also, you know, easily, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of that, of course, was, you know, editing and going back and revising, but, you know, work and what was going on with your life, you know, to where it all just flowed really well together, like when you talked about the fisherman's wife in the very beginning.
Right.
I loved how you did that. And then, and also the fact that you felt during your trip that sometime in your trip you needed to actually kill, skin, and cook what you were eating. So,
right. The complete journey of a dish.
Yeah. So, what made you? Did that just come naturally to you, or did when you were working on this, did you, you know, go, oh, you know, this works with this? Or I'm just kind of curious because when I was reading, I'm curious, did she take notes as she was on this trip, thinking she was going to write a book? Because I mean, that's literally how it came across. Like you were actually already journaling what you were going to do.
Were you journaling? Well, did you journal? I was journaling. I was keeping a journal the whole time that we were gone because, you know, one, because I do, and two, because I had a teacher in high school that used to talk about cocktail trivia. He always had, you know, he was so great. He would give you this little factoid and then be like, here's a little cocktail trivia for you. Mm-hmm. And I think I have that kind of brain that I'm always sort of trying. I read a lot of nonfiction. I read kind of relentlessly, and I read everything, but I also read a lot of nonfiction, including just about everything that has to do with food. And I've read everything from sort of the really dry, and I'm lucky. I'm good enough with French that I can read in French, and so I've read a lot of the French titles, and I've read a lot of you know, some really dry and some really interesting, you know, French works on the history of gastronomy and, you know, sort of the modern predicament of French cooking and the place of food in French culture. I actually joined this group that's called OCHA, and I can't now remember what it stands for, which is going to drive me crazy, but that ended up being this really sort of fascinating online community that, you know, puts on an annual conference that is looking at the intersection between changes in French culture and changes in French food and attitudes. And so, I mean, I'm a geeky on the food side, and so we use, you know, food knowledge and in metaphors from food in order to sort of help me relate to what was going on personally in my life. I think that was, I mean, one, this trip to France to go and kind of, you know, not recreate, but to follow in Waverly Root's footsteps, who, you know, wrote this fantastic book in 1958 called The Food of France, was something that I had wanted to do since I was in culinary school, so way back in 2000. So the idea, you know, the trip and the idea of going and being like a food anthropologist that would go and try to eat regional dishes, you know, in situ and see what they felt like and how they resonated when you enjoyed them in their native settings. I mean, that was something that had been in my mind for years and years and years and years and years before everything else came along.
So did you think, though, that this was going to be the book that you would end up writing? And, I mean, you're picked up by a traditional publisher, which is these days so hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so everybody knows it's Clarkson Potter that...
Potter, right. And,
producer.
I mean, you know, it's not easy to get published and... You know, being a writer for all those years and cooking, that it's a really great that you found something that you were actually going to get published in a good way, you know, that you would be proud of your work.
Yeah.
And sometimes you never know. That's the thing. What could happen in life?
No, and I was, when I started, you know, putting together what, you know, the part that became the book in my head originally did start out as a much more of a nonfiction food book that was about changes in French food and, you know, kind of, you know, tracing, you know, maybe the old bloodlines of dishes and talking about, you know, about the changes. And I think that what ended up happening is kind of like with the story with the bouillabaisse and the fishwife, is that I just kept seeing all of these parallels, you know, in part because I think, you know, one, I noticed that I was
almost sort of, you know, well, probably at the time, you know, I think I was a little bit angry in general when I got to France, you know, having come off of the heels of a, you know, a pretty stressful situation. I was pretty much a mess. And, but then I kept looking around at France and, you know, sometimes when you have that sense of what's wrong with you people, you know, a little, and that sounds, yeah. you know, I mean, far be it for me to lecture, you know, the French on their own food system. And you bring your own, you know, your own experiences and your own perception to everything that sounds like a critique coming out of your own lips.
Yeah.
But the idea was, is that I kept looking at the parallels between, you know, this lovingly built food culture that had survived so much and seemed so strong and that it was certain to weather, you know, any storm. And yet here you could travel the country and see in so many different ways how even just through, you know, seemingly innocent acts of benign neglect, it was changing, and it was maybe changing irrevocably. And I found a lot of parallels between that and what I thought had happened to Greg and I, how we had, you know, we built a marriage, you know, it had a certain foundation, and then we were subjected to, you know, the influences of children and you know, our competing reactions to becoming parents. And that same thing, this thing that we had thought was rather invulnerable had revealed that it had all sorts of fissures and cracks and was actually, could be taken apart, you know, rather easily if we weren't careful. And so to sort of put the two of those things side by side, then just started to make a lot of sense. And so when, you know, as the sort of nonfiction food book, that's how sort of the memoir line kind of grew into it, because I realized that I might be able to help people understand one story better by giving them the other story.
Other story,
so
right.
Constantly,
right.
Yeah, so yeah, that you were constantly, you know, you could, you know, like I could do something like, you know, talk about the, you know, the fisherman's wife, one of the things that she knows that she may lose is bouillabaisse, but she's not just losing, you know, bouillabaisse because of, you know, what's happening with the fish. It's that she's losing this entire life that she'd sort of counted on for forever, that she was going to have this certain kind of marriage, and it was based on a certain set of agreements about what things would be like, and but there would be all of these rewards that came along with it as well. And if all of a sudden you took all those away, you know, how would she feel about that? And, you know, I saw a lot of parallels with that between sort of, you know, like the, you know, a woman my age with kids, sort of thinking you were going to have, you know, one kind of life and finding yourself going, turns out this, I'm not getting that. I'm getting something entirely different. And do I feel okay about all the compromises? Mm-hmm. Or what, you know, what do I want to do? How do I want to handle this?
But that does happen a lot in life. You start one way and you turn out to do, you know, something completely different. So either you have to adjust or you don't adjust. And then everybody around you is miserable. So it seems like you've got your life together, though, right now. I mean, because talking to you,
I think that,
you know what you want now.
Yes, and traveling together was really how I sort of had to learn those lessons for myself. Basically learning to be a lot more honest with myself and to take more responsibility for what I wanted to get out of our marriage, take responsibility for, you know, for the weaknesses in it that we had created mutually too, so that, you know, I was mutually responsible for, you know, getting us into a rough spot, and I was mutually responsible then for getting us into a better one. And that I was going to, you know, we would both of us work a lot harder at being supportive and encouraging us to, you know, still pursue goals and dreams, and certainly that's what I got to do when I got to come home.
Well, this
is
one thing that you
work on putting together a book.
You want to be a strong woman. I mean, and you know, you don't. I mean, there's a fine line that you sometimes you cross, but sometimes you have to cross it. And to get to where you are now, you probably had to do that to know what you didn't want.
Well, other thing, mm-hmm. Marcia, when I was reading Amy's book, I guess I'm not even toward the end yet. I'm only a little halfway through it, but the one underlining thing I was noticing from, you know, as you would, you know, touch on what was going on, you know, with your marriage situation and obviously traveling together, I mean, the stress of traveling, you know, your husband sounds like my husband. He doesn't like to, I mean, he doesn't mind traveling, but with kids, he doesn't, you know, it's not the funnest thing in the world because he can avoid it, try to. So to me, it seemed like, and you even touched on it, you know, with some of like the comments you'd make, I could just tell like the underlying lining to a lot of it was, is getting you guys both to open up and to be honest in your communication.
Yeah.
Is really what I'm picking up, at least from what I've read so far. And I have to say, you know, that's probably one of the biggest things I think with people who want to be in these industries is so key, because if you hold back what you truly fear or how it's, you know, how you're perceiving it versus your partner, it's going to, you know, like you said, it's going to put those cracks, those fissures, you know, it's going to start eating away at the foundation. And, and I see that, you know, as, you know, where I'm at now in the book, that you guys have come to that point where you've really realized that.
Right.
Is there anything that you want to share or touch on that?
Well, no, I think that you are exactly right. I mean, you have to, when I was home and I was taking care of the kids and I wasn't working at all, I had a lot of conflicted emotions about that. I felt lonely. I felt isolated, you know, the sorts of feelings that I think a lot of women stay-at-home mothers can relate to, feeling a little desperate about whether or not you will ever get a chance to go back and, you know, and pursue your professional objectives or not again, or whether or not you now have put so much time on the resume that, you know, you're going to have to go all the way back to ground zero, or maybe you're going to have to even start some entirely different career because people are going to think that you don't have what it takes any longer and even to, you know, to do what you used to do. And I had all of those feelings, but what I didn't have at the time was I just didn't feel that if I said those things out loud that that Greg was going to understand. And part of that was, you know, probably my own fear, because I was a little bit, I think a lot of women, we worry about those feelings that we have. I mean, even though we can hear other women say that they feel the same way, we still worry that it reveals something lacking in us, you know, that we're not completely content, you know, in our new lives as stay-at-home mothers, that maybe somehow that reveals something. It sounds like you're saying that you don't want the job anymore, that you don't want the job of being a stay-at-home mom anymore.
Right.
And yet you know very, very well that you want that job very much and how much you,
that's the greatest,
you know, how much,
I mean,
you
really,
love it
when
and
you
how...
have children, that is the greatest. I mean, that's a great job. I mean, because that's wonderful. It really is. I mean, all the trials and tribulations that everybody feels, when they look at their children, especially when they're little or whatever, when they get older, and you look at them, they're your children. And, you know, you've been there for them, and then you're not sorry that you did that. You know, you may have a bad day one day, but, you know, this is what it's all about. I mean, is you're raising these kids, and, you know, that is an important job.
Yeah.
Because
you just can't let kids out
without raising them.
Right. I think it's just that sense of conflict that you want two things at the same time, and yet these things seem to be diametrically opposed to each other. So it's very hard to sort of get the words out of your mouth, because then maybe you're not even sure when you say them what you're then going to be asking for, you know, because, you know, are you asking them to stop doing it altogether? Are you saying you'd like to stop doing it some of the time? Are you saying, you know?
Well, you're trying to balance, which is a difficult thing sometimes.
Well, I was going to say another thing, too, is I think a lot of, as women, too, we all have this, and I think just society in general, we all have this idea of what the stay-at-home mommy is like, and they're like this, you know, superhuman, can do it all, happy kids, bakes, cooks, blah, 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 blah. I mean, my husband, when we first got married, you know, he came home from work, actually got home after me, because usually he got home before me when I was in fashion, and one day he was actually home after I was already home, and he made the comment to me when he walked in the door. He's like, "Hi, honey," and I went, "Yeah, hi," and I was, like, busy doing something, and he's like, "What, no, walk up to me, give me a hug, kiss, you know, how was your day?" And I'm just like, "Oh, you expected that?"
You know what, the Stepford Wives is something that, you know, always sticks in everybody's mind is, you know, like, oh, I don't want to be a Stepford, because Stepford Wives were everything was perfect and wonderful, and, you know, but that
and
was
the Stepford
Wives.
That was,
right, it's not reality, because, you know, there are days when, you know, you look at yourself in the mirror and you go like, oh, my God, you know, and you probably don't look bad, but you're looking at yourself and you go, oh, I don't like my hair, I need to get a haircut, I need to get another color hair, I need to change my clothes, you know, I mean, it's like those are the days that everybody has, and some people don't think about that everybody has them, but even the stars in Hollywood, they say, a lot of them, if they're honest, they say, you know what, I don't look like this, this is what they make me look like, but I look regular when I'm just out there. You know,
yeah, we're getting short on time, so I kind of want to, this is like the one thing I kind of wanted to touch on before we run out of time is, I know with me when I do interviews, everybody's like, oh, and, you know, is your family really supportive? Like, that's always like the number one question interviewers love asking. And, of course, you know, you want to be all diplomatic, and you're like, oh, yeah, you know, they pretty much support what I do. And you're really sitting there thinking, yeah, my husband wants to, you know, lock me in a closet and keep me away from doing what I'm doing because our house is going crazy. And, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, and you're so honest about that in your book. At the beginning, your husband was so not supportive of what you were doing, what choices you were making, doing this whole food net, you know, food show network thing. And, you know, but then as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, but now she's putting this all on paper. So with him being so against him having a celebrity for a wife, what was his reaction with this book?
I think I've gotten that question a lot. Yeah, it's kind of an obvious question, isn't it? It's like, you know, your husband was private and didn't want, you know, to be exposed by television. So then you go and you put everything into a book, and that doesn't sound like that works
at all.
Right, now
millions of people are reading it. Right, yeah.
Right. Well, one, I think that in order to really understand Greg and what his, you know, like I said, his reaction, what was going on, you know, his notion of privacy had a lot to do with sort of just, I think, the ability of our relationship to be, when it was just the two of us together, that I would actually be there and present. I mean, I think I said it, you know, earlier when we were talking, I said about how, you know, he didn't want to be married to the next Rachel Ray, but he also didn't want to be married to, you know, the Fortune 500 CEO or a military officer or something. He was worried about the level of distraction that would be introduced into our lives by having this sort of constantly, you know, ticking thing that was going on the sidelines. Because, and truthfully, you know, to neither of us, the book just doesn't feel the same way. A book just doesn't feel the same way. You know, I've laid bare an episode in our life, but I have, as much as there is there, he and I both know the things that are not there, and he and I both know the things that are, you know, that have remained private between the two of us.
Right.
And it's also like
you
have opened a door and you've said, you know, go ahead and you can take a look at this part. But then at the end of it, you know, you close the door again, and then you get, you know, you go back, and our life has continued since then. I mean, I finished writing this book in 2010, mm-hmm. I finished writing the book, and everything that transpired between, you know, the last episode, episode in the book is, you know, the kids and I cooking snails. And one of the reasons why I ended the book, I ended the book with the words, and I was talking about getting ready to cook the snails, and I was getting nervous. I was kind of revisiting, you know, my same feelings I'd had about the bunny, about, you know, could I do this? You know, was I prepared to drop these living creatures in the boiling water and, you know, take life from them? And the last words in the book, you know, I whisper courage to myself, and then I begin. And so the last words of the book are, and began. And in part, I look at it as is that, you know, you're, I guess I left it open to a lot of wonder for people about how we would make it. You know, would we be okay? Because, you know, now they've just read a book about us, and, you know, I've told you that our life is going to go on. I've told you
but,
that
you know, but
you've
done,
spent
you've done
time
a great job. And now you have a good life.
Yeah, well,
and I want to ask you, because I know we're going to have to get off soon, but I want to ask you a question. I mean, I'd like to have another show like this, and I'd love to have you on again, because you have a lot of good, you know, women need to hear this, because it's really important. So I think
I like
to be it.
I can fill up a lot of air time.
I know. So, yeah.
Well,
I'll
go on. Yeah, we can just put the last thing or whatever on the issue of oh, okay. Well, the last thing I want to say on the issue of, you know, of the book and of privacy, again, a book is, it's not your living, breathing self with the editing out of your hands. It's something that is much more, it's a version of yourself. And so given that, this was something, I think that it was very generous of him to sort of give me the book as a way on some fronts of kind of maybe making up for some of the things that he worried they've taken away from me, not just necessarily opportunities, but just sort of that sense of trust that
he would be there for me through the next
project. Before we
project.
Go, you want to say it's
really
Amazon.com. They can buy your book at Amazon.com, probably, I'm sure.
Uh-huh.
Amazon.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
and any bookstore, all the bookstores, yep.
Yep.
All right, and
Amy,
we appreciate
being here. Yeah, it's been great.
It's been great, great,
so,
really good.
Thank
like you. I really enjoyed
it. It sounds like you guys are on a happy road, so that's good. I'm glad to hear that. And I will let you know, my husband, when I told him that I was going to start taking writing courses and get into writing, I told him it's going to be a hobby. Obviously, it's not anymore. And we have Daisy supportive, and Daisy's not, but, you know, so you're not the only one out there. So thanks for coming on. And
thank you so much. And the name of the
welcome.
Book is How to Eat a Small Country. And I'm going to get it, read it, and then I'm going to call you.
All right. Sounds great. Right. I look forward to chatting with you about it.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
My-
Follow me to the world of ink.
And if those of you who are still listening would like to tune into our other shows, we have some upcoming shows this week. We actually, on Monday, April 18th, have Stories for Children with author Renee Han. We also have A Good Story is a Good Story with host Marcia Cook. And we will have another show on The Writing Mama on Friday. So we hope you tune in, and thank you for listening. And for those who are curious, it's Amy Finley was our guest, and her book is How to Eat a Small Country, A Family's Happiness One Meal at a Time. And thank you so much. Bye-bye.